Quietude is quietude, devoid of activity. Now, how can quietude be introduced in this movement of activity unless there is a principle of Purusha? This Purusha, who is by nature very quiet, inactive, immobile, he can introduce the principle of quietude through only one instrument, powerfully, that is buddhi. Because buddhi is the one principle which discriminates. Through the principle of buddhi, you can discriminate the quiet self, the Purusha, and the dynamic Prakriti. But buddhi itself being in the clutch of all these manas and ahankara and indriyas and all the objects of the indriyas, the whole panchamahabhutas, even buddhi is constantly running out of itself. Instead of discriminating, it is clouded. By introducing the power of Purusha on Prakriti, on buddhi, you can start as a process. Some steadiness of buddhi can be brought about by the power of Purusha. Now this putting the pressure of Purusha by himself on buddhi is called yoga. Starting point of yoga. The quietude of the Purusha being imprinted on buddhi, so that buddhi, which is being run out all the time, becomes slowly steady, one-pointers. This is the starting point of yoga. It's an effort by which the quietude of Purusha is attempted to be imprinted on buddhi. And because buddhi is a power of discrimination, it can receive the command of Purusha, discriminating it from the command of Prakriti. Therefore, the instrument by which you can do your yoga is buddhi. And this yoga gives you, first of all, when you make this buddhi more and more steady, it gives you the realization of the difference between the mobile and the immobile, between the perishable and the imperishable. And this was the starting point of the Bhagavad Gita's teaching, to make a distinction between the mobile and the immobile, perishable and the imperishable. And then comes the second part of the second chapter, where Sri Krishna says that I shall now teach you the poise by which, even while doing action, you will still be free. To distinguish between mobility and immobility, and arriving at immobility, is one realization, one liberation. But even while doing action, still you feel immobile, that is, karma bandhanat prahastasi, that is, even while doing action, while performing actions, you will not be bound. You will still be different, distinguishable, and capable of remaining quiet, even while engaged in action. Now this, how to become quiet even in action, so that you don't have to throw away the action. The teaching of Sri Krishna is, you fight, that is to say, he is asked to fight, to do action. But action means normally going into practice identification immediately. And all the trouble which Arjuna is now riddled with, Vishada. So how that Vishada could go and yet action could be, that was the real issue. So So Sri Krishna says, I will now teach you by which you will be able to act, and yet you will have no vishada, you will really be free. The other method is easy. Just come out of the action, renounce action. And according to Sankhya, there is no possibility of what Sri Krishna says. According to Sankhya, to be in action and yet to be free from action is not possible. There is a limitation of Sankhya. That is why you cannot say the teaching of Gita is Sankhya teaching. It takes into account Sankhya. It enunciates the whole Sankhya. It is aware of what Sankhya says. But answer that if you take only Sankhya, you can be liberated. If you want only liberation, fine. Then Sankhya is enough. But my ask, but I tell you, you act. And even while you act, you get the result of Sankhya. You still feel free. This is the alchemy. And this is the novelty of the teaching of the Gita, which was not available in Sankhya. According to Sankhya, the moment you discriminate between Purusha and Prakriti, then what happens? Purusha withdraws. It disengages itself. It remembers itself. Self-forgetfulness is gone. Identification is gone. Discrimination is complete. It knows it is different from Prakriti. And then, surprisingly, because the glancing activity is over, Prakriti comes back to, it does not anymore catch the Purusha. It becomes quiet also. In an analogy, it is said, Prakriti is like a dancer who starts dancing only when the master wants her to dance. And the moment the master feels disinterested in the dance, she stops dancing. Therefore, according to Sankhya, become disinterested in all these movements. Detach yourself from everything. And by vairagya, complete disinterestedness from it, the moment you come out of it, you'll be free. That is the remedy of Sankhya. And although Sri Krishna admits that this is a right process, valid process, it does happen. If you really withdraw yourself, your consent, your intention to look at Prakriti and identifying itself with it, you can become completely quiet, arrive at a complete quiet. All the riddles of the world, everything comes to a stop. You are free. But then do not expect that you will be acting at the same time and having this. By Sankhya alone, you do not have that answer. Therefore, there is another knowledge, which Sri Krishna says, the knowledge of yoga. The word yoga is used by Sri Krishna in a very peculiar sense, which Sri Krishna defines in the third chapter. Not in the second chapter, but in the third chapter, he says that by yoga, I mean karma yoga. So Sankhya is a path of knowledge. There is only discrimination by buddhi. Buddhi, which was caught by the three gunas, the buddhi which was hijacked, as it were, by movement of ahankara and manas and indriyas, that buddhi becomes separated, discriminating. And knowing that there is a Purusha behind, it itself becomes steady. Now it becomes free from the clutches of the ahankara, ego falls away, the movement, the driving force of three gunas goes away, and the Purusha returns to a state where there are no three gunas at all, completely quiet and silent. That is a path of knowledge. You know that there is a difference between Purusha and Prakriti. All movement is Prakriti's movement. Purusha is quiet and immobile. In immobility, there is no vishada, no consequences, no problem, no bondage. You are absolutely free. This knowledge and this attainment of this knowledge is called Sankhya. But by this process, you do not have the answer to the question of Arjuna when Sri Krishna says you must fight. So Sri Krishna says that the result of Sankhya can be obtained also by what I am telling you and much more. Therefore, if you have to choose between Sankhya and Yoga, I will tell you to choose Yoga and not Sankhya. I do not deny the validity of Sankhya, but I give you a preference to Yoga because you get through Yoga both the answers. This is what we shall do now next time. The process of Yoga, the buddhi applied to the movement of action. And then even while in action, how do you get the result of Sankhya? And much more than what Sankhya cannot give you. Alright? So last time you had a good analysis of the Sankhya. The word Sankhya itself comes from the word Sankhya. It is called Sankhya because it enumerates how many elements ultimately the whole world can be reduced to. The Sankhya is the whole world as we see it can be reduced to 24 elements. Plus there is Purusha. So 25 constitutes the whole world. So because it has enumerated these 25 elements, therefore it's called Sankhya. Again, between the, in 25, 24 are on one side, one is on the other side. Prakriti on one side and Purusha on the other side. So again, there is a numbering, number two. In other words, Sankhya philosophy is called dualistic philosophy. It considers two principles to be ultimate. The word dualism also is used in Indian philosophy for something else. The philosophy which says that there is a difference between God and man, the supreme soul and the individual soul. Philosophies which distinguish between the two is also called dualistic. But Sankhya is called dualistic because it considers the distinction between Prakriti and Purusha. Sankhya does not accept the existence of God. It is atheistic. According to Sankhya, you can explain the world without needing the existence of God. The whole world is nothing but the activity of Prakriti, which is triggered off by Purusha, by his glancing. And then the whole world can be explained in terms of these two principles interacting with each other. Now there is also Seshwara Sankhya. Nirishwara Sankhya is a classical Sankhya. There is also Seshwara Sankhya which also accepts that there is God. But it accepts God not as the cause of the world, but as the ruler of the world. The causation of the world is attributed only to Purusha and Prakriti. But there is also a supreme soul who can control things, who controls, intervenes. Now it is this Sankhya, Seshwara Sankhya, which is accepted by Yoga as we understand today. As I told you last time, there is an understanding of Sankhya which is not exactly shared by the Sankhya as I understood in the Gita. The word Sankhya is used, and when you read the word Sankhya, we think that Sankhya in the Gita means what we mean by Sankhya today. But that is not what Sri Krishna means by Sankhya when he uses the word Sankhya in the Gita. And I was trying to clarify that confusion. Up till now, whatever I have told you about Sankhya, I have to add only one word to whatever I had said last time. that Purusha, according to Sankhya, is multiple. There is not one Purusha, but there are many Purushas. Each one of us is a Purusha. Each one distinct from the other. Now, according to the Bhagavad Gita, the word Sankhya is used to indicate all that I have described so far, plus the idea that Purusha is not multiple but one. According to Vedantic Sankhya, which is the Gita Sankhya, Purusha is one, not many. Therefore, it is called monistic. Not dualistic, but monistic. So, Bhagavad Gita Sankhya is monistic. Vedantic Sankhya is monistic. There is only one reality. Even the so-called Prakriti, which is regarded as separate from Purusha in the Sankhya, is, according to the Gita, is a power of Purusha himself. It is not something different from Prakriti, from Purusha. Prakriti is in itself power of Purusha. And Prakriti, in regard to Prakriti, Purusha has four functions. In the case of Sankhya, as we understand normally, Purusha has only two functions. One is that it is drashta, it is a witness. And it is bhokta, it enjoys. It is also anumanta, it is also the one who gives sanction, but very passively. In the case of Bhagavad Gita Sankhya, which is Vedantic Sankhya, the Purusha is first of all Maheshwara. He is the Supreme Lord. So, Prakriti is under the control and command of Purusha. He is Bharta. He is not only Maheshwara, but he is also Bharta. Bharta is the one who actually fills Prakriti with all his energy. Prakriti would be nothing if this Bharta is a Purusha were not there. It is Purusha who fills. It is Purusha who husbands Prakriti. He is also Bhokta, also Anumanta. He also gives sanction, but not like Purusha of Sankhya, where Purusha gives sanction passively. In the Bhagavad Gita's view, Purusha is an active sanctioner. And he is also drashta, he also witnesses. Now these are some of the great statements of the Bhagavad Gita. What is the nature of Purusha? In one of the chapters, you will come across this very description very clearly. Drashta, Anumanta, Bharta, Bhokta, Maheshwara. In other words, Purusha, according to Bhagavad Gita, is Ishvara also. Purusha is also Brahman. According to Sankhya, as we understand it today, Purusha is not Brahman. Purusha is not Ishvara. In the Bhagavad Gita, the Purusha is at once Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara. And the energy, what is called Prakriti in the Bhagavad, in the Sankhya, ordinary Sankhya, the Sankhya as you understand this, is again threefold. It is the power of the Supreme, therefore is the Shakti. Prakriti is Shakti. Prakriti is Maya in the sense that it is that which measures the immeasurable, not in the sense of illusion, but In the original sense, the word maya means that it measures. The original word is ma. Ma mamati sa maya. That which measures. The reality is above all measure, is immeasurable. The immeasurable is being measured because all the forms that we see are all measurements. So the forms are brought out from the immeasurable, and that is the function of maya. So insofar as the energy of the Lord measures out from the immeasurable, she is also the maya. She is also Prakriti in the sense that she is an obedient servant of the Purusha, or the Brahman or Ishvara. So this energy has three functions. She is the supreme ruler of all that is created and shares therefore the rulership with the supreme Purusha. She measures out from Purusha, from Brahman, from Ishvara, all that has to be brought out. And she executes all that is willed by Purusha. This is the basic difference between the Sankhya as we understand it normally and the Sankhya that is given in the Bhagavad Gita. So, to conclude, all that we said about Sankhya last time is to be found in the Sankhya of the Gita. But add to that these three concepts. First, Sankhya does not accept the existence of God at all, except in the other form of Sankhya where it is called Seshwara Sankhya. Secondly, according to Sankhya, Purushas are many. According to Bhagavad Gita Sankhya, Purusha is only one. Thirdly, according to Sankhya, Purusha is only Drashta and Anumanta, but very passive Anumanta and Bhokta. Whereas according to Bhagavad Gita, Purusha is Drashta, Anumanta, Bhokta, Varta, Maheshwara. And along with it, therefore, the concept of Prakriti is different in the Sankhya, in the Sankhya of the Gita. Namely, that Prakriti is Shakti. She herself is the ruler, creator. She is Maya. She measures out from the immeasurable. And she is executrix. She executes all that is willed by the Supreme. In the ordinary Sankhya, these three are not present. Only one, namely executrix, is the only function in the ordinary Sankhya. Prakriti is only executrix. She is neither Shakti nor Maya. Now, after having said this, one more word has to be added. That although Purusha is one, Sri Krishna says that this one is capable of multiplicity. According to Sankhya, Purushas are many ultimately. Each one is independent of the other. Each one is ultimate. According to the Gita Sankhya, Purusha is one, but that very Purusha is multiple. Multiple is not ultimate. Ultimate is only one, but that one is multiple. In other words, each one of us is not an independent reality ultimately. Each one is nothing but a partial manifestation of the one. Each one of us is actually a manifestation of the Supreme. There are three important words about the individual given in the Bhagavad Gita. The one word is that the individual is called Jiva. Jiva is so called because it is that by virtue of which we seem to be alive. Because it is breathing in us, we are alive. Therefore, it's called jiva. Secondly, that this jiva is mama eva anshaha sanatanaha. This is the expression of the Bhagavad Gita, where Sri Krishna says that jiva is mama eva anshaha, is my own portion. Jiva is not independence, but my own portion. In other words, jiva is myself, as much as a portion could be oneself. Sanatanaha, it is eternal. It is my eternal portion. And how does it become manifest? The third sentence. It becomes manifest. Para prakritir jiva bhuta. This is another expression of the Bhagavad Gita. Para prakritir jiva bhuta. The jiva is that in which para prakriti has manifested itself. Para prakriti, not prakriti, but para prakriti. And this is a major difference between the ordinary Sankhya and Bhagavad Gita Sankhya. In the ordinary Sankhya, prakriti is only what Bhagavad Gita calls apara prakriti. But according to Sri Krishna, in the seventh chapter, you will come across this expression that I have two prakritis, not one prakriti. What is called normally prakriti is only my lower nature, is my apara prakriti. But I have a higher nature. I have apara prakriti. The apara prakriti consists of three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas. But para prakriti is not at all this trigunatmaka. It does not consist of these three gunas. It is dynamic, but not trigunatmaka. It is my higher nature, it manifests my own nature. The supreme divine nature, which is not limited, which is not obscured, which has not become lower, which has not become ignorant. The lower nature is a divisive nature, which seems to be dividing everything, which creates a sense of division, the sense of disharmony, the sense of strife. Whereas para prakriti is full of harmony, full of peace, full of knowledge, full of dynamism without obstruction. Not a dynamism in which there is strife, which is the nature of rajas. Not the nature of fever, which is also the nature of rajas in the lower nature. Human beings who are in the apara prakriti, they act by fever. There is a fever of desire, fever of impulse, fever of passion. It is by these movements that we act. The para prakriti does not act by any of these fever and movements. It acts supremely, sovereignly. It acts because it has got all fullness within her. And when there is a fullness, we don't act to gain something from outside. We act only to express what we already possess. It is not a seeking for possession from outside. It is simple expression, which is a true expression. And it, therefore, it's a play. That expression is not an expression of any struggle. It is a real play. It can play freely, sovereignly. That is the nature of para prakriti. Now, this concept is completely absent in the Sankhya as we know it. It is in Bhagavad Gita that this concept of para prakriti is greatly initiated, very clearly brought out. This concept of para prakriti is to be present, is also to be found present in the Upanishad. It is also to be found in the Veda. But not so clearly laid out as in the Bhagavad Gita. There is a late contribution of the Bhagavad Gita in the whole movement of Indian thought. In this, and going there, there is a concept of Aditi. Aditi is the supreme mother of the world. In Upanishad, also there is a concept. In Tera Upanishad, for example, there is a story. Gods had conquered. This is the story. Gods had conquered in a battle. And all the gods became extremely gratified. And they became proud. Their victory was theirs. They become victorious by their own power. Vayu, Agni, Indra, these three were the principal gods, and all the three were rejoicing in that time. Then the Supreme Lord comes forth as a small straw and challenges them to disturb it. But none of them is able to disturb. Vayu tries his best by the blow of wind to move it. And Vayu returns, Agni. He is very proud that anything in the world which is coming to existence, it cannot be without his knowledge. Agni is called Jata Veda in the Veda. The one who is born with knowledge. And anything that is born is known to us. That's why it's called Jata Veda. But even Agni is not able to make out what is this. Indra also is not able to find out. But then Indra goes forward in search. He admits he cannot find out. And then he is in search. Then he meets the woman. This is what the word in the Keno Upanishad. You meet a woman, that is Uma, Hemavati. And then it is Uma who reveals to him the Supreme Lord. And then says, it is by the Supreme Lord's power that you conquered. It's not your power. And that is why Indra became full of knowledge of the Supreme Lord. Uma, therefore, represents the Paraprakriti, who is even above these gods. Gods are children of Uma. According to the Veda, Aditi is the mother of all the gods, of all the things in the world. So, this concept of Aditi, this concept of Uma, the name is Paraprakriti in the Bhagavad Gita. In other words, you will see now, in the Bhagavad Gita there is a synthesis of Sankhya and Vedanta. Vedanta is monistic, and Vishya is monistic because reality is only one. Even Prakriti is nothing but the power of the one. Yet it accepts the distinction between Purusha and Prakriti, a subordinate distinction. Reality is one, but one that is two. It is at once Purusha and Prakriti. Therefore, the truth of Sankhya is also accepted. It also now reconciles Sankhya with Yoga. Now, it is that which I want to consider upon today. The Gita's thought reconciles Sankhya, Vedanta, and Yoga. In the time when this exposition was made by Sri Krishna to Arjuna, all the three schools of thought were prominent. And all of them were in quarrel with each other. Sri Krishna brings a kind of a harmonizing alchemy and puts them all together. And that is why Bhagavad Gita is called an integral knowledge. It puts everything in proper place and heals the quarrel between the three positions. It is on that harmony, that synthesis, that in the method of approaching reality, there is a harmony of knowledge, action and devotion. Karma, bhakti and jnana, all the three are reconciled because the reality that is to be realized is integral. Therefore, the method also has to be integral. That is why the teaching of the Gita is an integral teaching. Both ways, the object to be known, to be realized, to be possessed is integral. The method by which you approach is also integral. But before we come to that, let us concentrate now upon the word yoga. The word yoga appears first in the second chapter, which you have read through, when Sri Krishna says, "So far I have explained to you Buddhi Yoga, and I have given you the knowledge that can be obtained by Buddhi Yoga." Then he says, "Now I recommend you how Buddhi Yoga can be applied in yoga, and how by applying that Buddhi Yoga in yoga, you can be free even while acting. By the application of Buddhi Yoga, as far as the knowledge is concerned, Sankhya is concerned, you can be liberated from all action once you discriminate between Purusha and Prakriti. And we can come out of the clutches of Prakriti." That is what Sri Krishna has already explained in the first part of second chapter. Now in the second part of the second chapter, Sri Krishna explains how in yoga, even while doing actions, you can be free. The Sankhya can give you liberation when you come out of action. You withdraw from action and you can be liberated. But now Sri Krishna says that even while doing actions, you can still be free. That secret, he said, I will now explain to you. Now what does Sri Krishna mean by using the word yoga? What he means by this word is explicitly stated by Sri Krishna in the third chapter. In the third chapter, he says, there are two ways of liberation. There is one way, which is a Sankhya way. There is a second way, which is the way of yoga. Then he says, the Sankhya way is the way of knowledge. He makes it himself clear. The Sankhya way is called the way of knowledge. The yoga is the way of works.
Which works.
Yoga is used by Sri Krishna in the sentence works. Now this definition that yoga refers to works may sound to those who are familiar with the word yoga today rather strange. Because today the word yoga is specifically referred to a system which is called the system of Patanjali. It is a system which is called Raja Yoga. So we must distinguish between Raja Yoga, which is today famous as yoga, and the word yoga which is used in the Bhagavad Gita. If you don't make the distinction, if you read Bhagavad Gita with our familiarity with Raja Yoga of Patanjali, we will be misled and we will not understand properly. So now let us understand what is meant by yoga today. So that we can make very clear distinction between yoga, the word used by Sri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, and the word yoga is understood today in our ordinary men, ordinary situations today in our country. So, as you know, Indian philosophy has six systems, which are called orthodox systems of Indian philosophy. All the six systems of Indian philosophy, which are orthodox, accept Veda as Pramana. They accept the authority of the Veda. They all accept that whatever is in Veda is what we are expounding. Each one, although each one is quarreling with the other, but each one claims that it is expounding what is in the Veda and the Upanishad. There are two other philosophies in India which do not accept the authority of the Veda. These are Buddhism and Jainism. But both of them accept spiritual experience. In that sense, these two systems are in agreement with the other six systems which also believe in spiritual experience. These two are called heretic philosophies. Heretic means those which oppose the authority of the Veda. There is another system, one more system. It is called Charvaka system. It is a materialistic philosophy. It does not accept spiritual experience at all. It believes a human body and matter is the only reality. And after the body is burnt away, after death, what remains? Nothing remains. Therefore, it says that while you live, you try to gain maximum pleasure in the world. Avoid water and drink ghee. Jalam tyaktva ghatam piba. Because after the world, the whole body is finished, what remains? Nothing remains. Can you see anything? Nothing remains. All is gone. So Indian philosophy has got basically nine systems. Six philosophies are orthodox, which all accept the Veda. Two are heretic philosophies, which do not accept the authority of the Veda. They are Jainism and Buddhism, but both of them accept spiritual experience. Charvaka is a purely materialistic philosophy. The entire history of India, there have been so many philosophers, they have belonged to one or the other of these nine philosophies. Now, these six systems of Indian philosophy are known as follows: Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Sankhya, Yoga, Pura Mimamsa, and Uttar Mimamsa, which is also known as Vedanta. Uttar Mimamsa is also known as Vedanta. So these are the six systems of Indian philosophy. Now you will find that in this enumeration, there is one word yoga there. So today if you speak of yoga, people mean by that word yoga, that philosophy, which is one of these six systems. Now what is this system and what does it expound? Let us take it very loosely, some of the basic propositions of this philosophy. It is Patanjali who is supposed to have formulated the aphorisms of this philosophy. Therefore, Gautama is supposed to have formulated the aphorisms of Naya, Kanada of Vaisheshika, Prabhula of Sankhya, Patanjali of Yoga, Jainini for Purva Mimamsa and Badrayana for the Uttar Mimamsa. These are the basic philosophers, you might say, who gave the formulation in aphoristic forms. It's a very peculiarity of Indian philosophy that Buddhist texts of Indian philosophy are in aphoristic forms. The very first aphorism of Patanjali's yoga is, he defines yoga. Chitta vritti nirodha yoga. Yoga is nothing but chitta vritti nirodha. Nirodha means control, cessation. Chitta vritti, vritti means tendency of consciousness. Chitta is, of course, the stuff of consciousness. Chitta vritti, human being finds that his whole consciousness is full of tendencies. And these tendencies are constantly modulating. It's like a marketplace. The whole human mind is a marketplace. Bustle, bustle, and there is no space even to move about. One idea comes upon another idea, and before it is grasped, the third idea has already invaded you. And it is a tremendously busy place that constant commerce is going on between outside and inside. To make this consciousness absolutely still, according to Pancha Patanjali, that is yoga. Now, what is the process of making it still? The following is the process. First of all, you should observe yama and niyama. Yamas are five and niyamas are five. Yamas are rules, regulations. Yamas are certain attitudes which you develop in every activity. Satya is the first. Ahimsa is the second. Brahmacharya is the third. Asteya is the fourth. Non-stealing. Not steal, not covet possessions of the others. Aparigraha. Do not store beyond a certain limits. Aparigraha. Parigraha is the storing. Accumulating. Aparigraha is non-accumulation. Do not accumulate. In all your activities of life, according to Patanjali, you should practice these five things. In every activity, in thought, mind, speech, be truthful. Never hurt anybody. Complete non-injury. Brahmacharya. Complete continence. Asteya, do not steal anybody, something belongs to somebody else. This is from the Ishopanishad which you had seen earlier. Tena tyaktena bhungitaha ma vidaha tasya siddhanam. By renunciation you enjoy, but do not covet somebody else's wealth. Ma vidaha, do not covet. Ma vidaha tasya siddhanam. The wealth which belongs to anybody, whatsoever, do not covet it. This is asteya. Aparigraha is to keep your requirements limited and never accumulate. These are yamas. Then there are five niyamas. Shaucha, keep yourself clean. This is a niyama, this is a rule of life. Clean. Shama, be calm. Tapa, always be hardworking with austerity, concentrated, full of attention. Swadhyaya, apply yourself to the study. S. Santosha, self-contentment. These are the five niyamas. Now, when you have conquered these five things, or you have done this for a long time, then a strict process of psychological practice begins. Many people, not realizing the importance of yama and niyama, they neglect these two important steps. They go straight to the third step. That is asana. Asana is to take your posture erect, stable, comfortable. This is asana. Try to sit always as much as possible without any kind of movement of your body, without any kind of flagging, without any idleness. With all diligence, and try to be able to sit in the same position as long as possible. This asana has also a psychological meaning, not only a physical meaning. We have seen many people flying from one work to the other, taking the one work, giving it up after some time, taking the third, second work, after some time, giving it back, third work. This is the lack of asana. For any kind of yoga, when you start a work, keep stable to that work. If you go on flying from one work to the other, then you can never attain any kind of goal. It's like a rolling stone which gathers no moss. So do not become a rolling stone. You be stable. So this is the third step, asana. When you can be strong enough to rest in one good position, comfortable position, without strain, then you have achieved asana. Then comes the process of pranayama. It is based upon the idea of control of breath. It was found by the yogis in India that breath is an extremely vital thing in human life and in the world. In fact, the whole world is nothing but breathing. The whole world. It is Supreme Lord's breath. The whole world is Supreme Lord's breath. We should therefore know how to control the breath. Then we can command the whole world. And how do you do that? One of the simplest methods is our own breath control. If you can control your own breathing, and the simple processes of breathing is consist of three parts. There is inhalation of breath, and there is exhalation of breath. In between, there is a period when you can keep the breath inside your body, neither inhaling nor exhaling. Kumbhaka. Puraka, Kumbhaka, Rechaka. You inhale, keep it steady, and exhale. Now, when you can do this, you will find a great flow of energy in the body. And the powers of our consciousness begin to flower. Sometimes, with capacity to write, begins to flower. You may not be a poet till now, suddenly poetic faculty begins to open up. You may not be able to work hard for hours together, and suddenly you find that now we are able to work for hours together without fatigue. These are some of the results that we find as a of pranayama. Then, when we reach a certain stage of conquest in pranayama, then comes the starting point of the real psychological process. These are only physical processes. Asana and pranayama are only physical processes basically. Although they have psychological way also and psychological aspects also. That starts with what is called pratyahara. Pratyahara is followed by dharana. Dharana is followed by dhyana. And dhyana is followed by samadhi. These are the four processes which are purely psychological. Pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. Pratyahara is the attempt to fix yourself on one idea, one word, one image, one stop, one spot, one object, whatever it is. Select anything that you like. It is said that yoga is a science, and here you are not required to believe in anything, as opposed to religion, because religion starts the belief. You should start your beliefs. Whereas in yoga, have no belief. You just select any objects of your choice. Then see that you go on concentrating upon that object. In the first stage, what will happen is that so many ideas will come together apart from that very object. You start saying, I shall concentrate upon only this piece of metal. Then immediately so many other ideas will also cross in my mind. Pratyahara is a process in which you try to eliminate others and try to fix on one. So it is much more a kind of a struggle, you might say. Pratyahara is a struggle in which you try to eliminate all other ideas, excepting one idea on which you want to concentrate. This is pratyahara. Then, when you are able to fix your mind upon one idea for some time, then comes dharana. Dharana is to hold. Now you continue to hold upon one object. That which you have succeeded already in concentrating upon one object, now try to hold it for a certain duration. When you are able to hold it, then become fully concentrated upon it. And that is dhyana. To be fully concentrated on an object where nothing else in the object really remains in your consciousness. Like Arjuna shooting the eye of the bird, and we could see nothing else than that eye of the bird. That is dhyana. When you do this, then the object begins to reveal itself. This is the secret of yoga. The object begins to reveal itself in the state of concentration, of dhyana. Patanjali says that if you want to know anything from an idea of that object, from a word representing that object, or keep that object before you mentally, and when the stage of jhana will be reached after pratyahara and dharana, then the object itself will begin to reveal the knowledge which is regarding that particular object. This is what is called revelation of the objects.
object reveals itself. It is based upon the original concept that the knower and the known are basically one. The knower and the known, the subject and the object of knowledge are basically one. But this oneness is destroyed by our divisive consciousness, by our restlessness. Therefore, the knower and the known, when they meet each other, there is no concentration. Therefore, the object is obscured. There is too much of movement of other ideas coming across our consciousness, and therefore the object is not revealed to us. But if you can concentrate upon it, that because the knower and the known are one, in the exact state of identity, the knowledge is revealed. Plainly. In fact, there is one full chapter in the Raja Yoga, in the Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, which is called Vibhuti Pada. Various powers that begin to develop as a result of this concentration. If you want to know the knowledge of the whole astronomical objects, concentrate upon one astronomical object and that knowledge will come to you. Even the language of the birds, these ways can be understood if you can concentrate upon sound. And so on. Tremendous faculties develop in consciousness. But that is not the goal. These are only powers which develop as a result of this. The goal is samadhi. It is the last stage of the entire process. When we attain to samadhi, there is a tremendous intensity of concentration. So much of intensity that everything else is abolished. There is such an identity between you and the object. In fact, there are cases where people who go into trance, where externally they become so unconscious, that even to awake them is difficult. From sleep it is easier to awake somebody, but this is such a state that even to awake them is difficult. Sometimes you know, we want to inflict some pain on the body to make the body awake and to bring back the individual in ordinary consciousness. It is said of Sri Ramakrishna when he used to go into samadhi, to bring him back, people used to shout in his ears and then try to bring him back. But this is a state of intensity. In that state, there are two stages, savikalpa and nirvikalpa. Savikalpa is there is still a seed of thought. Nirvikalpa is one in which there is no seed of thought. It's such a silence, supreme silence, that you can then remain forever in that silence. Even if the body is left in that condition, your consciousness, which has attained that silence, remains. And then you are liberated from the entire movement of the world. So, through samadhi, you enter into a complete immobility of consciousness. Now, yoga system accepts the distinction between Purusha and Prakriti as in Sankhya. And therefore, it says that when you concentrate upon an object, you can concentrate upon Purusha. Among many objects, you can also take Purusha as one of the objects. And if you concentrate upon Purusha, then you realize the complete immobility and silence of Purusha and you become liberated. Or, yoga philosophy departs from Sankhya to some extent and says you are also the Lord. In the Sankhya proper, it is Nirishwara. But in yoga, yoga accepts the existence of God as a controller of the world. So it also says that you can devote yourself to the Lord. And if you in samadhi, if you go into that samadhi, you can become united with the Lord. Ishvara Pranidhana, surrender to the Lord, Ishvara Pranidhana, is also one of the niyamas in the yogic philosophy. You remember I gave you 5 niyamas, Shocha, Shama, Tapa, Swadhyaya, Santosha. Now Swadhyaya has an option, either do Swadhyaya or Ishvara Pranidhana. This is also one of the 5 rules of the yogic philosophy. Now this is in this the entire map of the philosophy that is called yoga. Now you will see that in this yoga there is not merely discrimination between Purusha and Prakriti as in Sankhya. There is much more. In the pure Sankhya, there is only a perception by Buddhi, a distinction between Prakriti and Purusha. And when you discriminate between the two, you arrive at the perception of Purusha. That is the method of Sankhya, in the ordinary Sankhya, not the Gita Sankhya. In yoga, this process of discriminating between Purusha and Prakriti is not done exactly by Buddhi yoga. You may do it, but it is not necessary. If you can concentrate upon any object, that is enough. And then you can go by Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana, Samadhi. Secondly, Pratyahara has to be preceded by Pranayama and Asana. In the Sankhya as properly known today, these two processes are not there at all. Nor is in the Sankhya the prescription of Yama and Niyama. In yoga, there is both Yama and Niyama. In Sankhya, there is no Ishvara Pranidhana. But in yoga, you have got Ishvara Pranidhana. So you can see that yoga known today is quite different from Sankhya known today. And you will see that yoga is much larger a process than the process that is proposed in Sankhya. Now if you want to summarize what is the distinction, you will find there are 3 distinctions. One is Yama and Niyama is largely connected with action. Yama and Niyama, both of them are to be applied in daily life. Daily life of activity. Therefore, you might say that there is a lot of karma yoga in what is known as yoga today. Secondly, there is also the process of concentration, which is also in Sankhya. In Sankhya, there is no karma yoga at all. In yoga, there is karma yoga. In Sankhya, there is a process of concentration. Here also is a process of concentration. So in this respect, it is very similar to Sankhya. In Sankhya, there is no Ishvara Pranidhana, but here there is Ishvara Pranidhana, the for lack of devotion. So yoga, as you know it today, has these 3 elements of karma yoga, jnana yoga, and bhakti yoga. All the 3 are present. But the karma yoga is greatly subordinated. Bhakti yoga is optional. Swadhyaya or Ishvara Pranidhana. But many emphasis is upon concentration, upon jnana. Therefore, yoga today, as known today, is largely a process of jnana yoga. All the other elements are present. But the word yoga used by Sri Krishna He himself says that yoga is primarily karma yoga. It's fundamental karma yoga.